Hi, this is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling and video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Ryan Benno and Ellen Shelley. Ryan has worked as an environment artist on such games as Hunted, The Demon's Forge, The Wolf Among Us, The Walking Dead, Sunset Overdrive, and Ratchet & Clank. And he was the senior environment artist on the recently released Spider-Man. He's also one of the hosts of the Environment Art Podcast. Ellen is currently a lighting artist at Supermassive Games and previously worked as a 3D artist at Sony's London Studio, a 3D environment artist at Little Wolf Studio Limited, and a VR developer at Yilo Architects. Thanks for coming on the show, you two.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, Ryan, how'd you break into games?
The story I tend to usually tell is that I knew at an early age I wanted to work in some sort of visual arts storytelling medium. And so when I got in high school, I actually had three choices for schools I wanted to go to, and I picked the worst one. I was either going to go to CalArts and go to their experimental animation department, since I lived a couple blocks down the way from there. I was going to go either to USC for their film school, and then the third option was an art institute in Los Angeles for game art. And initially, I was going to go to CalArts, but my instincts were that I wanted to be a 2D artist. I wasn't really interested in 3D. And my senior year of high school, Disney decided to fire all of their 2D feature animators. And I was like, oh, maybe I don't want to get into this. I should maybe think about getting into games, because that seems like that's a safer job security space. Yeah. And so I ended up going to the Art Institute, which those schools, I think, have kind of a reputation. But the one that I went to was good. The class I was in was really good. And through there, I actually learned how to love 3D and really fell in love with the creation of it, the design of it in games, and the challenges that come along with trying to make something run in real time. And also just games in general, I think, like as a storytelling medium. When I started college in 2004, it was like, oh yeah, you know, like this is still a pretty early medium. There's in terms of storytelling, there's a lot of interesting things that you can kind of do in it. And environments kind of blended into that idea of doing both visual art design as well as storytelling design. So after I left school, I worked as a contractor for a couple of years. I worked on Hunted the Demon's Forge, like you guys mentioned. But after about a year and a half of that, I finally landed at Telltale, and I was there for about a year and a half or so. And that was kind of my first full-time gig, and really was like the culmination of all those things I wanted to do, of like storytelling and environment design.
So when you were looking at those other colleges, were you also like wanting to work in video games if you had gone to them, or would you want to do more film and TV stuff?
I was thinking more film and TV, but I think at the end of the day, it really was like, at the time, my thought was, hey, there's a lot of really cool stuff to do in games. A lot of my influences in high school had been more game focused. I grew up as I think like a lot of us, you know, playing a lot of NES, Super NES, playing a lot of platformer games, Mario, and then during high school I discovered RPGs, and that was just like a life-changing thing of just like, oh, look at the, you know, a lot of the PlayStation 1 Final Fantasy games, and just seeing the production value on those, you know, jumping from, you know, the Super Nintendo, the N64, to seeing, you know, the cutscene that opens up Final Fantasy 9. Like, yeah. That was kind of the leap I was going to, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is just like crazy, the level of detail and polish that's in this stuff. And so for me, I think that was where my mindset was at the time. It's like, oh, games would be kind of a fun thing to do on top of either doing animation or doing film. So that's kind of what I went with.
And so when you went into games, did you start going like, I want to do environmental art, or did you want to do something else that was storytelling focused?
I was thinking of concept design, which is what I think a lot of students that end up getting into those fields kind of focus on, and then I realized I wasn't very good at drawing, and so 3D is where, right? So 3D is kind of where I ended up going, like, okay, I feel like I'm pretty good at this. I think I can get a good handle on this. So, you know, I jumped around even thinking about doing design for a little bit, and then realized I couldn't really program either and could barely script. So I was like, yeah, nope, I'm gonna stick with the art end of things.
Is that something that you think could people want to get into industry now? Is that still a path they could do, or you think they should be like, oh, I should know programming more now, and I should know 2D and 3D?
No, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of schools now that focus on that. There's like Ringling in Florida is pumping out a lot of really good art, like environment-focused artists out here in the States. You know, any time that you can learn another discipline, it definitely helps you get a leg up. If you're an environment artist that can also program, that's great, because then that gives you a whole another level of like skill sets and things that you can use to help build whatever you're building. A lot of what it means to be an environment artist is it's very craftsmanship focused and very technical most of the time in terms of the day in and day out work. So anytime that you can kind of use that stuff that's not like put up against a wall like most artists, including myself in particular, it's very like at a certain point there's just like, I don't know how to do this because I can't script or code. But there are people that like I've worked with in the past that have that ability and are able to be like, oh, I can just make my own program or script to be able to like generate trees. And you're like, cool, I'm going to sit here and just fiddle around and try to figure out how to make trees, like brute forcing it with the tools that I have, you know? So things like that are definitely a huge advantage, but it's definitely rare to see someone like that.
Okay. Do you know how to script or code, Ellen?
No, I don't. Like Ryan was saying, environment art, a lot of work goes into it. So I think it's to also be able to sort of program on top of that is quite impressive in a sense. So no, I'm the same. Like, it's interesting that Ryan said trees, because that's also sometimes the thing that I struggle with. So I've used stuff like SpeedTree and pre-made programs like that and will sort of bend it to what I want. But no, I've had a little dabble, but nothing solid with programming.
And how do you break into games?
Mine was so I was a traditional artist, same really, like I really liked concept art, I really liked digital art, and I never really got on very well with school. It wasn't something I really quite liked. It was quite structured, and I used to just sort of draw in my maths books and stuff, and I think from that point I knew that I was going to be a sort of an artist. And I was originally going to go down the sort of the Art Foundation route. And I remember sort of actually going to sign up in a college in my hometown to you know, sign up onto this course. And I walked down the corridor, and at the end there was all this game art. And I just sort of completely forgot what I was going to do and just went into this studio. And there's all these students' work and things. And I was like, this is art in its sense. This is just so impressive. I always liked games anyway, but I was really impressed from the sort of the art point of view. So from that point, I just kind of just signed up. I just like, I want to do this like course. And it wasn't even a very big one. It was just like a sort of foundation into games. It was about 2 years. It was a sort of taster of like everything. So from there, I finished the course and I made sort of, it was old UDK kind of stuff. And then I didn't really want to go to university. I don't know what it was. I think it was the whole school thing, the whole sort of structure of it all. So I never went. I actually got into, just for our fluke of luck, I went to this like small architects in Brighton, and they were really looking at VR at the time. It was really new, and I just said in the interview like, oh yeah, I'm interested in VR, I've done some game engine work. And I think from that point they were like, oh, we've bought you the Oculus Rift, we want you to make our project into VR. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I managed it. I mean, it was a bit like, oh gosh. There was a few YouTube videos involved. Some of my friends that are already sort of in the game industry helped with some certain things. But I managed to pull it off. I managed to get the Oculus to work and one of their projects to work in VR. And then from that point, I just started learning more Unreal Engine 4, just in this architects, just, you know, just making all their projects into like full levels. And then in my spare time, because I really like fantasy stuff, I used what I learned at this architects to make sort of my own environments. So I just, yeah, just it's similar stuff between architecture and even fantasy stuff. Like there's still structures, there's still, so for example, I've done a church scene that was kind of based off proper blueprints, like architectural blueprints for a real church. So even when you do fantasy stuff, there's a lot of realism involved with certain stuff. And then from that point, I just started posting on Twitter. It was actually Twitter that kind of kickstarted it all. I was a bit hesitant to sort of get Twitter. And then my friend was like, oh no, you should, like, have a go, like just post some stuff. And then from there, some indie studios wanted to sort of get me to help them with certain things, so they saw my work. And it literally rolled from there, really.
Did not going to university, has that been an issue for getting work at all?
I wouldn't say it has. I'd say it's been more of an issue with how hard I've pushed myself with everything. Like, the whole structure of me learning has been on me, really. I'd say that's where most of the struggles come from. Like, if I did get stuck there, I'd always sort of try and work it out myself and things. And I do think maybe if I'd gone the university route, maybe it'd be easier, maybe it wouldn't have been. But I just think, for me, I liked learning on my own. I've always kind of liked pushing myself, and like, I like the challenge as well. But no, it hasn't. I think a strong portfolio, or just showing a keen interest in the work you do, is enough.
Yeah, I totally agree. Mm-hmm. Do you think, do people getting into the industry, do they need a university degree, or should they go to university at all?
That's a great question.
Is it worth it anymore with the internet and how high tuition costs are?
That's actually that was a major thing for me as well, because they got put up massively. I was the year that the tuition fees got sort of maxed out, and I think that was definitely a deciding factor to it.
Yeah, I mean, out here too, you know, there's so many different ways to do it now. I think there's plenty of artists now too that are kind of getting together and doing like mentorships or doing like classes that I think, you know, then there's plenty of free information out there. You know, at the end of the day too, like, it can be helpful for like networking at certain places. There is a structure to that that I know for me in particular, I really needed when I was early on, like, was just like getting into that like mindset and structure of like working long hours in front of a computer and being able to just like build up to that and being able to have like actual deadlines for that stuff. So, you know, I think it kind of varies from person to person, but if you're looking at just the content of like what you're looking for, then yeah, there's plenty of resources online for that stuff.
I was going to comment on that. Because I was working in an architect's and it was long hours in front of a computer, I think that's where I got the structure from, which I think Ryan makes a good point. You do get that from university. You do start to get used to that because, yeah, it is very structured and there are deadlines to art and things. So that is a plus side to university.
Ryan, since you've been in the industry for a while, have you ever seen studios where they are prejudiced against people who don't have a university degree, or do most students not care?
Yeah, at least on the art, and we technically don't, you know, I've never really seen anybody go, oh, we shouldn't hire this person because they don't have a degree. You know, at the end of the day, it's really just the quality of your work and your portfolio is what matters the most, I think.
Yeah.
When it comes to stuff. So, you know, that's another thing as well too. It's like, well, you could say you went to the school, but, you know, it doesn't really matter if the work that you're showing isn't up to it's either not up to the par or it's not matching with the place that you're applying at and that you're trying to work at.
Yeah.
Because I've known people that will do the full years and come out with barely anything in their portfolios. And it's definitely work-related. What you've produced, even just making a small game with your friends can sometimes be more of an impact than doing a prestigious degree in the end.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, I have seen schools, you know, it also depends on the school you go to, if anything, and the structure that's in. I think it's better for students to have an experience of working within multiple disciplines making a game, rather than just being like, all right, just pump out a bunch of like portfolio pieces, right? Like, here's like a room, fill it in with a bunch of stuff, take some pictures and show that you can place stuff inside of Unreal and call it a day, right?
Yeah.
That's not as valuable in a production sense than someone that's actually been able to work with a designer and programmer and try to get something that's actually like finished.
That was one thing I learned. It's like you pass work from one to the other, and portfolio pieces are, we've all kind of done it. Like, I've spent a long period of time on a portfolio piece, but when you're in the industry, it's a big group of people are involved in an environment. It's not always just the environment artist. So, and you also have to work to a deadline. So that kind of learning to collaborate is a really quite a strong trait to have, I think, early on.
Like, how do you show the collaboration when you're trying to get a job then? Is it just more in like the a cover letter or in describing in interviews? Because we're not environmental artists, so is that something that comes across easily in portfolio pieces?
No, it's really not. I know from my past experience of having helped hire other people, it's something, especially when you're getting someone who is new to the industry, you kind of have to take a chance on them and just kind of have, you hope your gut feeling about how they work with other people will pan out. But that can always, that's not a tangible thing. Depending on the game and the studio you're working at, you might be working with upwards of 60 or 70 other artists in house, or it might just be you, right? Like Kate Craig at Fulbright, she's it. There's nobody else, unless they've hired someone recently, but on Gone Home, she made most of the stuff in that game.
I think especially in indie, you have to kind of do multiple things. So I think sometimes the way you become a 3D environment artist and sort of bigger projects is from that route of doing smaller ones yourself and then going into indie, and then that can be a natural progression.
Yeah, and then I want to use that to dive into environmental art. Either of you can answer, but where do you start when you're creating an environment? Is it the same every time? And when you're creating an environment for the first time, how much background info about it do you want from the writers or creative directors or other team members?
It really depends on the game.
It really depends on the project or what you want to achieve from that environment.
Yeah, it's there's a difference between making a Telltale game versus making Spider-Man. In terms of how that stuff is laid out. In my experience, just having been at a few different places, I have found there's usually a theme of a designer will go in to some extent and do a very rough block out and just they'll go into Maya or use something inside of the engine and just kind of block some stuff out. And then from that standpoint, then an artist comes in and starts putting in closer to final geometry, put some textures, put some materials. You might have a lighter come in, or you might be the lighter on your team, so you might go and do a pass on that stuff. When it comes to getting an understanding of what's happening in the scene, I think it's important, for me anyways, I tend to always ask questions what are the themes inside of here? What are the actual events that are happening in the space? And then also things what do you want the audience to feel or the player to feel as they're progressing through the space? Because that helps me to also figure out things like color choice and lighting and the shape of objects.
I was going to say, sometimes a room can literally be molded around a sort of an item that a player has to get, and then you have to talk to the lighting artists, as in where do you want the light to be coming from? Is there are there holes in the ceiling? Sort of how much decay is there? It's not always just one person that decides what the environment's going to look like.
Right. And it can be kind of a collaborative effort between design, creative, other departments like effects and audio really can kind of come into play. If there's let's say more of a traditional game, if you have a big boss fight or something in it, right? You want stuff breaking around in the space and having all this chaos that's kind of happening in there, that's a combination of us coming in there and doing an environment pass and doing different stages of that environment changing over time. That's effects coming in and adding in different, whether it's stuff that's breaking or different visual effects that might be kind of happening throughout the fight. That's audio coming into play and doing adjustments based off of that stuff. That's design usually hooking all that stuff up. If you have writing or creative coming on board and doing additional things on that too, right? It's all those things have to kind of come together to really help sell whatever the main idea of it and kind of the journey of the scene that you're going to go through together as a team.
And when you're talking to all these people and they're giving you, asking them questions, you're getting information, is there a point when there's too much information becomes a hindrance, or do you want as much information as you can get from everyone?
So for me, if you overload the information at the start, I think that can be a bit detrimental to sort of the end result. It's nice to start with a concept and a sort of an objective. So For example, the player, it's an environment to push the player forward, and so therefore it needs to be quite narrow, for example. And then there's some sort of design choices, like how dark you want it, what's the mood that you want the player to feel. And sometimes that's enough, really, to kind of start with it. And I find adding information as you go along can be more helpful, because obviously an environment changes with all the people you work with, and that can be a better way to kind of develop an environment rather than going, it has to be like this at the start, and there's no room for change, which is rare that ever happens, but that can stop some artists from maybe like creating stuff faster or more effectively.
I tend to usually really like a lot of information.
I know, it's different,
but yeah. But like, I also feel like I'm kind of okay with parsing out pieces that I need or that I don't need. It's mostly just like, if anything, I kind of see it as like when you do like focus testing, is like, okay, what's the collective message that everybody's trying to say, right? Like, someone in this department might be saying kind of the same thing or having sort of issues or wants to get the same point across as like two other people, but they might be saying it in different ways or getting different types of information. So I think it's good sometimes just to be able to kind of get everybody together and get all that information and say, like, okay, what are the things I actually need and that I don't need, you know?
Yeah, that is really helpful.
Yeah, and I, you know, like, it can be a little maddening at times, depending on how many people are in the room and how many people have a say. I was going to say,
sometimes in some studios we don't sit together, so all these little collaborative ideas are going on in a studio, and yeah, it's just such a silly thing sometimes you just forget to do. It's just like, let's just all talk together, like in the same space.
A lot of times, though, too, I find that sometimes I have to ask questions that I don't always get answers to, and it might just be things that other people think, oh, this person already knows that, right? They might have sent out a script or sent out an outline for what's going to be happening in a specific space, and they just, you know, might be like, oh, yeah, we have all this answered, and then I thought this would be obvious, right? And that's not always necessarily the case either. And so sometimes you have to dig through that stuff.
Yeah. And when you're talking to all these different departments and getting all this information, I assume it's used for other artists on your team. Like, is there a shared document that everyone uses, or how does everyone get access to all this information?
Yeah, the best way I found that that's usually helpful is by doing things like style guides. So that can either be like a document, either in like a Word style or like a PowerPoint style, that actually like gathers all that information together. So
sometimes for stuff it can like, just be like a collection of pictures or sort of references. For lighting, they do that quite a lot. They'll pick films just to keep the kind of tone the same.
Yeah, that's a great example. We did that quite a bit on Spider-Man. Actually, was when we were working on the open world, the whole concept is like, hey, we have to make Manhattan, right? So we have to understand all the different boroughs and like the neighborhoods within those boroughs. And so we would go in and make a document that was based off of like Greenwich Village and just talk about the architecture style, the history of the neighborhood in terms of like how it developed, the type of people that are there, you know, through the last 100 years or so is kind of what we aimed at. And then we would actually pick films that were set in those parts of Manhattan, which was kind of nice because at least you're like, okay, this is a big enough city that you can name like 3 or 4 films that have been in like Harlem and Hell's Kitchen and Greenwich.
Yeah.
And so that can also help to give everybody kind of a general tone and just have a, you know, be like, okay, here's the general theme we're going with. Play within that realm of like those different spaces.
So style guide to what you would use too, Ellen?
Yeah, it's very, very similar to what I'm used to as well. Yeah, sometimes they will have, it's films. So they'll all reference for a tone and style that they want to achieve. And that just makes everyone really clear on sort of the objective. And then there's been other occasions where there'll be some parts of a game that will be brought up to a sort of a standard, sort of an example almost, to kind of stick to. Sometimes you can slightly go a little bit away from the style, but only in certain bits, but generally they like to kind of refer back to the images. And sometimes there might even be like a particular scenes from films. Like, there might not even be a whole film that we use. It might just be like this scene here. We want this throughout the game. It really depends.
When you have an environment that you're trying to get across the specific theme or emotion, do you have any past work
where you can remember a specific experience where you really struggled to get it across?
I think it depends. So with lighting, for example, there might be a time of day that the game is set in. And then I've had points where the references will be a completely different time of day. And it's just like trying to, it was really difficult. It was like, so the game set sort of at dusk, and the scene that we're referencing is set in like bright afternoon, but you want it to like kind of be the same. But yeah, that was really tricky. And I think we did it in the end with just colour, just sort of colour was the way to kind of like tie it together. But I remember fighting, being like, okay, this is like a dark reference. And it was just, yeah, it was a mess. And it was this kind of back and forth fighting. But we did get it in the end. Neither of us were like budging. But yeah, it did look good. But oh man, it took ages. They just wouldn't change it. It was like, no, it has to be this time of day. Like, okay. So yeah, sometimes there can be a bit of like creative differences. But part of the job is, you know, talking together and coming up with a nice outcome, really.
Yeah, and you will a lot of times get like, okay, we want this thing, but it's got to be like these other things that contradict
yeah,
like the inherent nature of these of the other thing that we want you to make, right? So it's important to find not necessarily compromises, but finding the thing that kind of works with both of those scenes, right? It's like, okay, you want it to be like this, but it's slightly different than this, so what at its like fundamental core is similar, right? So like color, kind of like what Ellen was saying, is a great example of that, right? It's like, okay, maybe it isn't the same time of day, but we can use similar color tones or the same idea of color to get the same response out of people in that way. And that's at least kind of a nice way to get yourself out of those things. It's like, hey, there are different ways to accomplish the same goal and get people to feel the same thing.
Yeah, with like shadows, for example, like a certain time of day, shadows are like a longer or darker, and it's just like, okay, so it might not be like the time of day we want. But what Ryan was saying, what bits can we take out of that that are the main things that you're trying to get across? So is it the dark shadows? Is it the tones? So that's a way of working it out.
Yeah. Do you have any specific examples, Ryan, of past work that you could talk about?
There's stuff that's failed.
Any the Demon Forge?
Yeah, for sure. We can go over that.
Is that a PS3 game? Where did that come out on?
That was a 360 PS3 game, yeah. So that was, in the case of that wasn't even questions or like the idea of pacing from a narrative standpoint, you weren't really addressed with trying to solve those as problems in the development of that, you know. They weren't even asked. And when you did ask them, they would be, you know, you might have people be like, why is this? Why do you care about this? This isn't important. So, and that's something that, you know, you can definitely find, I think, any place you go to, even in places that have like strong narrative ties to the games that they make, you'll find people are just like, why are you worrying about this? This doesn't matter. And it's like, well, it can, and it can help elevate what's already there, right? Maybe there's something in there that's just like lacking, or it's just not up to the par that you would expect it to. And you're like, well, what things can, you know, we do as visual artists to kind of help sell this idea, right? And I think when you can start working in that way and everyone can start asking kind of the same questions of like, how do we get this point across in this particular moment in the game or this particular moment in story, with having all the different departments asking themselves like what specifically you can bring to the table for that, I think you get a better overall product and you get a better result overall. At least for the games I've worked on that have been the most fun to work on or the ones that have been successful, I think that's what usually comes out of it. It's just everyone gets in a room together and says, okay, what can you bring? What can you bring? How do we solve this problem together, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It kind of relates to what Elle was saying before about creative differences. And I want to ask, either of you can answer, but how do you learn to navigate creative differences when they occur? Because it's not really something you can learn at university, or they don't teach at university or anywhere. Is it just something that you learn through experiencing them when they show up, or what?
I think the best way to kind of do it, so because there are people that feel very strongly about certain aspects and they almost seem like they're not going to budge on what they want. So I think the best way to kind of do it is just to like sit down and then to don't ever say, oh, I don't want that bit in there because I just don't like it. Or no, the way you kind of navigate that is by giving reasons why it's not working. So for example, there was a certain environment maybe wasn't working because that it was holding up the lighting artists, like there wasn't enough places for they. So it might be even a dark environment, but there still wasn't enough sort of fake places to bring the light through, and maybe the designers didn't want to change that. They just were like, no, this is how it is, this is where all the walls are going, the players, and that could just be it. We could just be like, okay, that's fine. But we all knew that at the end of the day, like, it was going to make a better experience for the player. So if that is going to be the case, you need to kind of just sit down and you need to sort of list, or not even list, just say why you would like them to change certain bits and what the kind of outcome would be. And that usually helps with them wanting to kind of change stuff. So yeah, you don't compromise, you just kind of meet in the middle. So that always works better than just turning around and being like, oh god, that is horrible, I don't want that. Yeah, you just gotta just be nice. Sometimes tea helps.
Yeah, it's I totally agree with that too. Like, I found if you present it as a question and a problem first, and that you know that other stakeholders can empathize with that, it definitely helps. Pictures also help a lot of times too, or having actual examples. More times than not, if you can show some sort of visual, whether in like a mock-up or...
Yeah, even just like the thing in Photoshop with the good old overlay. Like, here you go, here's where the light's going to come in, boys. And they're like, oh, yeah, that can help.
Yeah, that's, you know, just having that be like, oh, right, okay, cool, that seems good, you know. Or, you know, if anything, it's like, look, I laid everything out here on the table, I knew I explained this well, and if someone still is like, no, we don't really want to do this, then you just like... You know, you have to say, okay, you know, that's just a call. You know, a lot of cases too, it's a bit of a power structure, right? It's like, if you're trying to change the minds of the directors that are running the game and they say no, then, you know, that's it, you know. But if you're trying to change other people that you're working collaboratively with it and trying to get them on the same page about things, you know, that's where, you know, having that sit down with them and just, you know, taking them out to lunch or just, you know, coming by their desk and just chatting, not about the problem you have, but just being like, hey, how's it going? That can definitely kind of help to like build better bonds that down the road, you know, can definitely help to like get an understanding of like how to address somebody during problems.
No, like you say with the whole director thing, if you want to change something that's further away from you, isn't like sort of directly linked, sometimes there are the reasons why stuff is like that. So yeah, just work. Sometimes pick your battles as well, I'd suggest.
Like, how much do these situations take up, like, a percentage of your overall work, would you say?
I think it depends. It depends. Sometimes there are certain parts of the game that are more challenging than others.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say like a... There's not really confrontation. I think whenever you make a video game, it all kind of gets built up together. So you will... I think it's a natural process, actually, of making a game, is you will have to... Unfortunately, guys, you're going to have to talk to your other teammates about certain aspects. So, I'd say sometimes quite a lot, sometimes not. It really depends.
And with that, I have no segue to go into this, but I want to talk about environmental storytelling for a bit. Ryan, on Twitter, you talk a lot about environmental storytelling, and one of your recent tweets said that environmental storytelling isn't just bullet holes and bloodstains. Then, all caps, you said, stop. So, like, I want to hear from both of you, but what is environmental storytelling?
No, it's definitely puddles, that's for sure. I think the thing that, you know, like, to, like, go back to that first part before like I kind of answer the actual question. A lot of the times, I think as environment artists, we probably stare more at like people's portfolios than we do at actual games. So we're exposed way more to a lot of different people doing tons of different things online, right? Like in like our field, the website ArtStation's a big deal because that's where most people kind of post their portfolio and their work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you'll just, once in a while, you'll just be browsing kind of through there and just being like, oh my gosh, why is everything in here, you know, environment-wise, like, bullet holes and blood, you know, and like I have students as well. I've been doing like a mentorship for the last 2.5 years, and usually the way I lay that stuff out from them when they're starting the mentorship is like, hey, pitch me on an idea, you know, story matters in terms of what you wanted to do. And a good amount of them I've gotten back are like, I'm gonna do this scene. Usually it's a sci-fi hallway.
I was about to say, is it a spaceship?
It's a spaceship.
With some vents and some neon lights.
And they're like, yeah, you know, a fight broke out. There's bullets and blood
and puddles.
Just like, yeah, puddles. I'm just like, yeah, man, I've heard this a lot, right? And I've seen that even with like professionals, people that have been doing this for a long time, is like, you know, that type of stuff is like, yeah. I mean, that's a detail, but that's not really telling a story, right? And I think it's important to keep that in mind, that like the things about storytelling that we have to do is really tied to whatever, let's say for a project, you know, it's tied to creative, it's tied to narrative, like whatever they kind of come up with. We are supplementing those ideas and trying to find ways to elevate them in the right circumstances, usually through visual storytelling ways, right? We can't really rely on audio to come in. Like, if we're talking about just purely, like, environmental storytelling, it is, like, there's really no audio that's involved. It's strictly just on the visuals. And outside of, like, someone sitting and reading a piece of paper that they can pick up in a game and look at it, like, that's not really the way that we can operate. So it is, like, you have to kind of take into account the type of game that you're working on. You know, the perspective the player's taking. Are you doing a first person? Are you doing third person over the shoulder? Are you doing top down, side scroller? And that really can kind of inform the way that you address that type of information across the way. So I think things like themes are really important, which we've kind of already talked about a little bit, right? Or asking kind of the question of like, hey, like, what do you want people to feel in the space? Like, what's going to happen? And that stuff I've always found has been really successful, is if you have a strong theme of what's happening in the space, then that helps to fill in everything else. If you have a flow of events that happen, it helps too.
Some of the, so for example, Dark Souls, there isn't a guy going, oh, now you're in the scary room with the dead people in the middle. it's the reason they're quite successful is because the environments are, yeah, it's strong. Like, so even like Bloodborne, there is a really strong theme, so it's all very gothic, but there are sort of major sort of key points and areas that let the player know what's going on. So it's quite obvious, and so it's almost like the player will kind of come in after an event has happened, and the environment artists have sort of left stuff around to let the player know kind of the story before they turned up, what happened. So there might be sort of like smashed in doors, there might be like, I don't know, there might be like claw marks, there might be it's some of those subtle things like that, not bullet holes, but I'm just saying, yeah, it's kind of, the job is to know what you want the player to feel. Do you want them to feel like they're not meant to be in an area? Are there things stopping you from like wanting to go further, in a sense? Even the layout of environments can tell a story. For example, there might be a sort of a certain place where people have tried to flee a scene, and there might be all their stuff might be just sort of all piled up next to a wall where you can kind of tell them, oh, maybe they failed. That's where everyone went. That's where they all died. It's just stuff like that really that helps tell a story.
Yeah. And Bloodborne, I think, is one of the best examples of this. It's a master class at the stuff. It's so good. One of my favorite examples of what they do, that's a combination of environment art storytelling plus other departments involved as well, is that there are, I forget what they're called in-game, but they're an item. They're pretty much just like a lantern that has like a particular color to the light. And you can pick up the item, look in your inventory, and it says something like, hey, this keeps away the beasts. And it's an item that you can use in-game, but you can also see it in the environment. And any of the doors that you can interact with in terms of, like, knocking on and somebody will answer, they all have those lights placed in front of them somewhere. And that's a combination of, like, not just the environmenters putting stuff in there, but that's the writers and creative wanting that, plus you have UI and the designers that make up the inventory to get that information in there, you know, and that stuff is really cool, you know, and that allows you, you know, like that combination of the different systems and departments working together really make a game feel like it's like a lived in space. It doesn't just feel like it's like, oh, the UI is like a separate entity from the entire world. It's like, no, the UI and the inventory is all one and the same as the world.
So why do you think that kind of quality of environmental storytelling doesn't happen more often in like AAA games? Is it because that collaboration of that nature is really hard to do with big studios?
I think it depends on what the kind of outcome of the game is.
Yeah, I find it's usually just people don't ask and don't think it's as important.
Yeah, for example, they're very subtle things in Bloodborne. Just a color of a lamp. Like, if you said that to someone, they'd be like, well, we don't have time. It's not. But it's those little things that just, they really make a world. It just made me want to moan more and more, like those tiny things. And the great satisfaction you'd get as well from just knowing a little bit more about what's been happening is just great.
Yeah. And it's being able to make the time to polish that stuff too, right? And I think you might be like, I want to do this thing, but I literally have to build this whole street first before I can think about putting like the light in here, right? And you're like, all right, you got 2 months to build this entire thing. Do it, you know? And if you don't have time between that 2 months, you may not go back to that area at a certain point, or you may not have the opportunity to go back and do that. And so I think it's a, you know, it's a combination of things of just time, schedule, priorities of what people think are important to kind of add to things. You know, like, I think, though, like, one of the most important influences for me as an environment artist when it comes to the storytelling aspect is thinking of stuff outside of popular media that's not directly related to what games are good at, which is like being in the moment, you know, like being able to be a character walking in a space moment by moment, second by second, and what like the thought is of just walking between a hallway, you know, like I think of like something like PT, right? It's literally just an L-shaped hallway, and it is terrifying to go from one end of that thing to another. You know, but
that's because there's such a big collaboration for that feeling. There's audio, right. There's lighting, there's, yeah, it's, I think that's what makes games so great. It's like this big collaboration of lots of different skills to make me absolutely terrified of a hallway.
And like, it's also about like understanding how to make somebody feel something that's having like a lived experience, right? Like being able to walk from one end of a room and you're feeling terrified, or like you want people to feel terrified. Why are they feeling that way, right? There's a number of different ways you can like explore that idea as they're just kind of crossing the threshold through a space, right? So I think things like live theater is really important, you know, even though people aren't necessarily participating in it, it's there, it's in front of you, right? There are people on stage with real lights and real things going on. Or even stuff like, you know, like the famous like murder mystery dinner shows, right? They're super hokey and cheesy, but there's something magical about being in a space where it's like, you know, people are like, half the people here are like paid to be there and acting along
the
way.
Are they really? I thought you've ruined it for me. No,
oh, I'm sorry.
Never gonna go again now.
Oh, no. You know, and even stuff like theme park design and things like that, I think are really fascinating in terms of how that stuff is built and how like people think about, okay, how do we get people's attention?
Are you about to tell me that Disneyland isn't real? I don't know if I'm ready for that.
I don't want to turn this podcast into an entire Disney appreciation discussion, so I will stop that.
I'd be up for that.
I could talk about that for hours easily. Yeah. So yeah,
I'll save that for the end.
Yeah, there you go.
I wanted to, like, this is related to a question I had from a few minutes ago that I didn't get to ask, but when you mentioned the sci-fi hallways, is a problem with seeing those all the time in portfolios that a lot of people's influences are very insular, that it's all like video games and not focused on outside media, that,
or they're all taken from the same influences.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a, I don't know, because art can be very unique, and I think that's what makes the really good video game something special is because people have brought different ideas to it. And I think when you're starting out in video games, they kind of assume that the art style of a video game is video gamey art style, if that makes sense. Like, that's what they've seen. They've seen the steamy sci-fi hallway. They've seen the sort of zombie derelict bus kind of thing, and they assume that that's what they've got to kind of make in order to make it a video game portfolio, which is not always the case. It can be completely out there. I mean, I think that it can be just different. I think that's what really excites me when in sort of ArtStation, it's like, oh, that's different. That they haven't done that before. They've actually, right, you know, used the software and made something unique in an art form. Yeah, that's what I think. It can get a little bit, not cliche in a sense, but just a bit saturated with, I think, what people sometimes assume should be in a game portfolio.
Yeah, like, I think as an artist, I tend to usually want to do stuff that I feel like really speaks to me. And so it's like, hey, like, how am I feeling today? How am I feeling lately? What's been on my mind? And then having that influence my personal work. And so that's led me down some interesting paths in terms of just making different environments, portfolio pieces, or different experiments to kind of play around with at home. And it definitely helps to stand out. There's just so many people that are trying to get into this industry as environment artists, and you have to find some way to stand out beyond just, hey, you know how to make a good looking model texture and you can light stuff, right? A lot of times it's like, what else can you bring? Like, what are the intangible things to a team? Especially if you're joining, you know, the smaller the team, the more important that stuff needs to be to kind of stand out. If you're working in a studio that's like 90 artists, it's not as important as a studio if you're working with two artists.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, when I did my environments, I just did them because as a compositional art piece sometimes, almost, like, this is what I was feeling, or I've been influenced by something, and I just did it. Sometimes there might be even just a colour that makes me want to work on something. There isn't always a structure. It is literally just because I want to, and I want it to kind of speak a sort of mood or what I'm feeling at the time. And I think that's what you shouldn't do art because you assume that's what people want to see. You should do art because that's what you want to do, and that's what's speaking to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, what else is up there with sci-fi hallway that you see a lot of these days?
Oh, God.
Okay. Overgrown environments is one I've seen a lot. Anything abandoned, you name it, like, that seems to be a nice theme for stuff. I've done one.
I've done an abandoned church with overgrown vines in it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, anything with a spaceship is usually pretty up there with stuff. I'd say, like, hand-painted fantasy assets is definitely something you see quite a bit of. Although, I would say that the ones of those that pull off that like work are ones that just aesthetically are really pleasing. So it's like, hey, if you aim to do something like that, then that's great. There's the giant tomb in the gravestone. I've seen a lot of
That one, just a gravestone. Just hand-painted gravestones. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, make it a bit different,
right? I'm like, look, hey, like, can we do more like suburban track homes?
Just, yeah,
like, do more. Like, I would love to see more people doing that type of stuff. If anything, it's like, all right, take a mundane idea, or like what we would consider mundane, and try to do something really cool with it. Try to make that look as visually appealing and compelling as possible.
Instead of portfolios, what takes you out of an environment when you're actually playing a game that comes out?
I think very, very video gamey things. Like, for example, like if anything glows, like if an item will literally glow at you, that ruins it for me. It's like, I'm gonna see this item, I'm gonna get to that, but I don't always want that. That kind of ruins it for me. Or when there's really obvious lighting, it's just like, hey, I'm here. That will destroy the immersion for me sometimes.
Mine's not necessarily environment focused, but it would be like animation cycles that are
really bad. Yeah.
I saw one from a game yesterday. I will not name the game, but it is one that many people are talking about right now, being really unpolished. And the character was in a tight room, and anytime he moved, he would just run. And, like, just like standstill. So it'd be like you go from this tiny little space in the room from one desk to another desk, and he's just constantly running back and forth. Just anything, you know, like that. like, not necessarily take me out of a game in a bad way, but like any sort of fun stuff that accidentally happens when a system is playing with each other. So something in like Red Dead. I came across a guy the other day playing the game. It was like a prisoner that was just like hanging out in a bush, and he called out to me. He's like, "Hey man, can you like shoot these chains off of my feet so I can go?" And so I was about to do it, and then just a horse came by and ran him over.
I saw that. That was amazing. Oh,
like that takes you out of the game, but it's also enjoyable and fun. And for me, I'm like, all right, that's, you know, like that's a memorable moment, right? It's not necessarily like a negative.
And it's like it takes you out of the game just because that's something you wouldn't really see in any other game. Like it's believable for that world, so it should work.
Yeah,
totally. Like, we talked about this a bit already a few minutes ago, but Ryan, in another tweet thread you had, you discussed the practical things one can do to get beyond a lot of the environmental art tropes out there, saying that exposing oneself to other mediums is a good one because there are a lot of narrative and visual techniques that are really great that games are just simply, they haven't tried as much.
Mm-hmm.
So could either of you give some examples of those?
Photography, some composition. That's one of my favorite things. I love photography. Just even on my sort of, I've had people being like, "What camera do you use?" It's like, it's just an iPhone. Literally, it's nothing. It's just wandering around. I'm really annoying to all my friends. Like, they'll all walk off, and I'm just like staring at something with my iPhone. Just photography. Games are, well, they're visual, and there are, for example, with Uncharted, there are literally points that will make the player, will push the player to a point in the environment, and everything will have been placed in a sort of picture-perfect kind of way. And that's all come from composition and, you know, just looking at that kind of, those other mediums.
Yeah, I think any way that you can kind of sell the idea that a space can be lived in, it's important because inherently the way we work, everything is kind of is tidy and nice, just like working in, like, geometry, right? Like, if you were to do, like, an old cardboard box, you know, there's going to be bent edges to something. It's going to be kind of soft on specific areas. And if I were just to make a box in, like, any of the 3D programs that we use, it's going to just literally be a hard-edged box, right? So we're fighting against that inherently. So it's extra work for us to be able to kind of put that, like, the dents and the dings on specific things.
I think what the environment's like, too, in a game. So if it's, like, it's raining, the box isn't going to, like, I love how we're just attacking this box. This box is not going to have perfect edges. It's going to be, like, it's going to be soggy. It's going to be, like, it's stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that stuff all adds up to it. In terms of what I've seen in other mediums that I think games can try to pull from, you know, kind of like I mentioned, I think, like, any sort of, like, experiential medium that allows you to kind of, you know, like, being in a space and being able to walk through it is way more in tune to me than like a film where like you're fixed to specific camera angles for stuff. You know, again, it kind of depends on the game you're playing, right? If your game is focused on camera cuts and things changing, then that makes sense. But you know, if I'm working on like a third person,
well, like like Last of Us kind of thing, the environments are, they're really messy, but but they're not just sort of, an artist hasn't just gone in there and gone, "Wah!" They've like placed stuff for you to find. They've placed stuff as if like an actual person has put that down. And that's the little stuff that is just, it's great. It's really, really nice for the player and people playing it.
And, you know, to talk about that a little bit too, is like, you know, The Last of Us, even though that's a third person game, it's totally different from like an open world game, you know, where players can go at anywhere at any point. And so if you're thinking about stuff from a narrative standpoint and a pacing standpoint, you're like, well, I got to throw that out the window in terms of the world being able to be used in that way, right? Versus like if you were to do like an Uncharted or a Last of Us where those games are very linear in nature, you know, they may have areas where you can kind of explore a little bit, but for the most part, you're going from space to space and you're not really going back at that point, right? So you get more control over the way that stuff gets presented. You know, that's more of a traditional idea of like, all right, this thing happens and then this happens.
Is it hard to, because like Spider-Man is a very open world game, is it harder for you to do environmental art in that regard because of the disregard for pacing, or you can't control pacing so well?
I think it's just thinking about it in a different way, right? It's more about, instead of trying to tell a linear story, it's more about, like, putting in little pockets of stories that all add up together to tell you about a specific space, right? So, like, again, if I were to talk about, like, the neighborhoods in Manhattan that we did, there was a lot of, there were very particular themes and stories we wanted to tell about those spaces. And so we knew we needed to create opportunities that players could potentially walk into that all add up to the bigger theme of what the neighborhood was about, right?
Yeah.
And so in that way, yeah, it's a different challenge, but you can still accomplish kind of the same goal. It's just like, you know, you couldn't tell the story necessarily about one individual person in that neighborhood and their journey through, you know, the events of the game per se, right? Unless you, like, force a player to be able to kind of look at that, or, like, you hint at them to do that. It's more of, like, how can we tell a story about a larger group of people through smaller examples that all kind of emphasize the same points.
Yeah. When you're both starting out, like, from square one with an environment, do you struggle with the blank screen, or do you start creating pretty quickly? If you do struggle, how do you get past it?
I won't even start like that now. So I've learned the hard way, definitely, with some environments. With scale, I will literally just, I'll have an idea, and then I will list almost what I need, what I needed this, like how many rocks, how many sort of like, you know, what's going to be the main hero asset, the main thing the player's going to look at. And then once I've got that kind of down, I'll go straight into Unreal and I'll just start just shoving down rectangles, just getting the scale in, just putting down a life-size figure, like to scale person, just the default Unreal person, just to start doing that. Because it can be very different scale in a 3D space as if you are going straight from a digital painted concept. So I think, yeah, it is good to sort of list what you want and then just start just putting anything, just start building the composition and the depth of a scene. I think that helps, yeah. To just get going, really.
Yeah, I would agree. I tend to usually like to work from reference as well as, again, right, like having an understanding of the theme and the idea that I want to work with. If I'm thinking I want to build a very specific space, right, I'm like, oh, I really want to make, like, let's just continue this, a suburban track home, right? I just want to do a bunch of that stuff. I'll be like, that's cool, but why do I want to build that, right? Like, to me, that's not as interesting as, like, okay, but why, like what story can I put into there? What can get me excited to get ideas generated from just like a pure excitement and wanting to work on something, but also like solve the problem of what am I going to put in the scene, right? Like, what am I going to put in there? To bring up Spider-Man a little bit, it would be like, if you were to make, you know, if like I were to tell you, hey, go make a 20 something year old's studio apartment in the middle of Manhattan versus, hey, go make Peter Parker's apartment, totally different mindsets that you would have for that, right? The 20 something, you'd be like, I don't even know who this person is. And then your mind starts going to like very generic ideas of like what that might be, versus like if you give someone a defined thing like Peter Parker, that instantly fills you up with like tons of ideas that you can kind of start to run with, right? So you know the character you have, and you know there's intent in there. It can generate like asset lists for you as well, you know, be like, oh, I can make these like 100 assets. I don't have a time to make 100 of these assets, but I can cherry pick maybe the best like 20 or 30 of them and then make them work within the scene that I'm trying to make.
I think so. You have to also remember, this is one sort of, well, I have to keep reminding myself, you are one person when you do your sort of personal stuff. You need to pick your battles. It can be very like, say if I was going to on my own make Peter Parker's apartment, that's a massive job for one person. So yeah, pick the main things, pick the idea that you want to get across and start sort of working into that. It can be sometimes quite easy to get a bit burnt out with a project after, because they do take a long time sometimes, and especially if you're doing them on and off at lunch or after work, you need to be a bit careful with your time as well and where you're going to put that. How you're going to sort of allocate that energy you've got left to making this environment. So it's all this stuff that kind of plays into what goes into the final outcome.
Yeah, and kind of like what you just said too, is like building environments is a very time-consuming thing to do. We can't just sketch a series of props down. We have to build all those props in like a three-dimensional space, and we have to make them feel and work right within that. And the process to make that stuff usually involves sometimes somewhere between 3 to 6 different programs you have to run your models and textures through, and then you put it into the game engine, and then you got to assemble all that stuff into there, and you have to hook it all up and get it to work in there, and that's just for like one individual prop, right? Like, that's even for something like, you know, a wall. Maybe a wall might be as simple as like, all right, here's a texture, here's a material that I have with those textures, here's my wall geometry, I'll bring that into Unreal or I'll bring it into my game engine and place it around. But anything else that's like remotely any more complicated than that, that's where, you know, it involves a much more complicated and time-consuming process.
It can be very easy to overcomplicate stuff as well. There's so many programs out there. You don't always have to use all of them. I think sometimes you can get a bit overwhelmed with the tools that are there, and you kind of need to reel it back and remember what you're trying to achieve. So if you want to achieve like, you know, just a brick texture, would just a simple brick texture be enough? Do you need to go into sort of surface design, or do you need to make loads of parameters? Because at the end of the day, you've only done one wall. You've still got like a bed. You've still got Peter Parker's entire chest of drawers to make. So you've got to pick your priorities, I think. And if you can make stuff easy for yourself, just do it.
Yeah. Or, you know, in certain cases, you can also just outsource all of it and then just do the stuff that you really want to do. That's definitely a reality for a lot of AAA places now, is that, you know, we outsource a lot of our props. It's like, you need the person in-house that is going to be able to assemble the room. You don't need the person in-house that's going to make the chair that's going to be in the room.
It can really saturate a team as well if they're, you know, they've got just chair after chair after chair to make, and they still realize they've got an entire structure. So yeah, outsourcing can play a big part in it.
We kind of already talked about this a little bit, but Spider-Man's my example. We can talk about in general with other projects. When you're designing a real-world environment or lighting one that people will know immediately if things are off, how do you alter it enough to direct a narrative experience from it, while also, what do you know that you can't tweak or touch?
That is a great question.
I think it depends on the style of the game. Some games you can get away with certain things more than others. I think if you're going for full realism, that's really difficult, because the human eye is just like, they can spot it instantly if something's off. So it's very difficult to change certain things, I think, with that. Even sort of realistic lighting, if you're going to go for full realism with lighting, if it's even a little bit too orange, for example, the human eye will be like, no, that's wrong. But if you've got stuff that is more sort of slightly off realism, it's easier to change that kind of stuff, because it matches the whole sort of style of the game. So if the colors are a bit more contrasted, you can get away with making the sky a bit more artsy, a bit more beautiful. It depends, really.
It's also the challenge of, I'm not gonna look, I love my designers, every designer I've ever worked with, they're all great, but sometimes it's like, man, you want to make a breakable wall in this one little area. I have no idea how that wall would break. Makes no sense why that would be there, right?
It just has to break, man.
Yeah. it's like, hey, this one thing, what if I make this ceiling in this closet 3 stories tall? Is that okay?
Just do it. You're an artist. You can do that.
Yeah, I'm like, well, I could... let me see what I can do, right? Yeah, and like, you still want the design of the game to work out well, right? Like, there has to be some sort of intent in that, right? It's like, hey, I think it's important to also remember that the art can't necessarily get in the way of the design either. If players react well to a specific thing, and you put some art into a space that makes it really difficult to traverse through a spot, you know, even in like a over-the-shoulder third-person cover game, right? If you have boxes everywhere where the player is like moving like a tank, and any small thing that impedes their movement just stops them, you know, people are just not going to enjoy the game.
Or if it makes the camera like really harsh, because sometimes the designers will edit the sort of the cameras based on the environment, and it makes me just feel sick in some games.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Like camera collision, anything kind of, you know, like you still want that to work out well. So the challenge on our end then is to try to make stuff feel believable. Not necessarily realistic, because I think if you start getting to that point, you drive yourself crazy.
Yeah.
And also, it doesn't always make for a better
experience. Also, you don't always want that, do you, when you play video games?
No.
Well, I don't.
No, definitely not. it's that balance of just trying to find stuff that makes sense. Or, you know, I've had pretty good relationships with lighting artists that I've worked with in the past when it comes to trying to figure out how to, like, light stuff from a design standpoint, as well as also from, like, an aesthetic choice as well. It's just, like, it's a balancing act of working with lighting artists who are like, hey, I want to put my lights here, and you're like, cool, I don't know what I can put here to support the idea that there's a light source here, right?
I know a few lighting artists, including myself, that have done environments too, and that can really help, I think, having an understanding of how environments are made, especially, yeah, because they do go hand in hand, really.
Have you had any, like, encounters with environment artists who struggle with that idea of, like, hey, I'm going to put a light here, can you figure out how to put, like, a model here to support that idea?
I've had it with sort of ceilings sometimes, or rooms where there literally isn't a way to let in any natural light. I mean, they're like, oh, but you don't need natural light because you can do full artificial lighting. It's like, but sometimes when you have the odd hint of, like, moonlight or sunlight or something, you don't have to, it doesn't work with every environment, but when you have a big open space environment and it's all artificial lighting, it can just look very video gamey. And mm-hmm. I was trying, it was a kind of bash heads thing I had where I really wanted just some realistic light coming through to kind of break that up. And we did get there in the end, and I did show examples of before and after. And like we said earlier, it was that we overcame by just showing examples of why I wanted it like that.
Yeah, again, right, like it kind of goes back to the idea of just making something feel believable to the player. You know, I made the joke about the, like, three-story high ceiling in a closet, but, like, I've built environments before where, from a design perspective, is like, no, the ceilings need to be this high, and you're like, yeah, but in real life the ceilings would not be this high. But then you have people play it and nobody makes a comment about it at all. There's no feedback from testers. It goes out there into the public's hands and nobody says anything. You're like, okay, cool, works for me, right?
Yeah. Ellen, you kind of talked about this before when you mentioned the shiny objects taking you out of a game when you encounter them playing games, but, like, readability is a big part of what environmental art is. So how do you do it well without making something so obvious or noticeable to players that it pretty much takes them out of a game?
It's difficult, but so it doesn't always happen. Sometimes you really have to be very obvious with certain things, and then sometimes you don't. For example, yeah, Bloodborne does it quite well. There's just, if there's, like, a lot of debris on the floor, for example, and then there's just not any debris, and there's just one singular item, that can sometimes be enough for a player to be like, oh, that's a bit out of place, that's a bit weird. Why is there just one thing there? And that could just be enough. It doesn't have to glow, it doesn't have to be anything on it. It can just look a little bit out of place sometimes for a player to just go over and interact with it, or just see if it is anything. Or sometimes, for example, like, it can glow, but when the player is close to it, that's fine. But there's nothing, I really hate it when you enter a room and the first thing I've noticed is some glowing lever at the back of the space. It's like, that just ruins it. I don't want to know that yet. I want to see the environment. I want to walk around a little bit, and then I want to kind of do that. It's almost like forcing me through in a way, like it's going, oh, right, there's the next thing, let's just run through. That I really quite like to avoid.
I think there's a lot of really interesting discussions going on in the industry right now about accessibility, not just from, like, helping out people that physically cannot do specific things, but also from how players want to kind of control their experience.
Oh, yeah. Tomb Raider did the really good one, didn't it, recently?
Right.
The difficulties with that, the actual difficulties were based on, yeah, readability, like the environment being more obvious for the player.
Yeah, and I think a lot of cases in AAA, you know, we tend to usually want to make games more accessible and just have people enjoy the experience versus, like, trying to make it a literal challenge, right? Like, if you're in a room and you're supposed to interact with, like, 30 objects and you can't tell which 30 objects they are like, a material that either makes everything shiny or makes it look like there's, like, a light passing over it every 5 seconds.
Yeah, it really depends, doesn't it? Yeah, it depends on what the objective is.
Yeah. But then there's also people who are like, no, actually, I want to do that. I want to be able to take my time and explore this stuff. And you're like, cool, okay, well, then maybe that needs to be an option that we make in the future and just let players know, hey, that's something that you can turn on or off, right? Just make that something that's exposable to
Sometimes, yeah, like pacing players. As well for a game. Like if you want the player to quickly do it, you'll make it glow. Mm-hmm. But if you want them to slow down a little bit, you won't. You'll hide right. it a bit more.
Yeah. And so I think moving forward, that'll be kind of an interesting thing. I'm curious to see how designers handle that as well, right? It's like, okay, what if you have these multiple choices in terms of the way that players can experience it? How do we design something in place that we, you know, do we just design to the default setting, or do we design with all these different settings in mind? And, you know, that'll definitely affect our work down the road as well. It's like, how does that stuff, readability and things like that too? You know, because you could also be like, easy way to make readability for any situation is just have a giant arrow pointed in the direction of where the player needs to go, right? And you're good to go. And some players are totally fine with that. Others are like, get that out of my face. Like, I don't want anything to do with that at all.
Yeah. We like talking about mistakes and failures on here because they're often super helpful with improving your skills and reminds people that nobody bats 1,000. So what mistakes or failures have both of you learned the most from?
Mine was my limits, I think. I think as an artist, you don't have an endless sort of, you don't have an endless energy in your mind to just keep creating. It is a resource, and I learned that quite recently. So I was trying to get a personal project done. I was hammering it. I was hammering it on the train back and forth from where I lived all the way up to London, and I was doing it back and forth for an hour, and I did that for about 2 weeks. And the quality of my work did suffer, and I did get it done, but I definitely learned my limits with that kind of stuff. And it has helped me as an artist to take it more easy, to almost sometimes even taking twice as long is better, has a better result at the end than trying to get it done quickly. And I think with that as well, planning, I used to just go tearing straight into a piece. Without any sort of idea of how long it's going to take me or how much is involved. But now, from that, I've learnt with my limits to kind of prioritise what I want and what I want to achieve. So, yeah, that's my main one.
That's a great lesson to learn, is really knowing like what you're capable of and what your strengths are and not driving yourself crazy.
Yeah, so I think even ArtStation, in a sense, you always see all this art. You sometimes put a lot of pressure on yourself as an artist. Well, I know I do, and it's like, oh, got to create more. And you get in this kind of vicious circle of almost this pressure, this unneeded pressure, and it can actually stop you from progressing if you stress too much about what ArtStation is doing, I haven't done a piece in about 3 months. Sometimes it is better just to step back and take your time.
Yeah, I think it's there's that pressure that I think comes from, artists are very sensitive people, and
yep.
we tend to be, even the smallest criticism, I don't care how stonewall you might yep. appear, everyone inside is like being like, oh my gosh, they hate everything I'm doing.
You all remember this, that one guy on the internet that said something forever.
Yeah. It's like, you might post a piece and you might get 800 comments, everyone's like, this is totally great, and then you just get one be like, I don't
like the brick texture. You're like, oh my god.
Yeah, be like, oh, no.
This guy saw through everything.
Oh, I'm a fake. He's found me out. Yeah.
But like, it's kind of that mentality that, for my point anyways, is also, it kind of contributes to as well, which is that like, not everything you have to make needs to be at 11, right? Like, no. Not every individual asset you make has to be the best of whatever that thing is, right? You just have to figure out the best way that things can be serviceable, and then figure out where to put the most focus and attention to the things that you're making.
It's the overall thing at the end, basically, because there are parts in a piece where I'm like, God, I wish I'd just done more of that, or I really hate that one thing. And at the end of the day, sometimes people just don't see it. It's
yeah.
I will always see it forever, but it's like we say, like with the ceilings not being the right height, so they just won't. They just sometimes won't see it, and you've put all that extra pressure on yourself that sometimes just isn't needed.
Yeah, I remember. So there was a point in the first season of Walking Dead where the last scene for the game, the scene where Clementine's walking through the hills, that was a totally different environment. And I had spent probably about 3 weeks trying to make it. It was still an outdoor scene with hills, but it was like on a cliff and you were looking down on stuff. And we had never made anything like that on the project from like a style standpoint. And I was like tasked to go and make this thing. And I spent a whole bunch of time experimenting on things, trying to get stuff to look as good as I can. People seemed to like it. And then literally at the 11th hour, they're like, yeah, we're going to change the shot and change the environment. So I had to completely scrap that environment. And within 48 hours before we were supposed to submit, change the environment, make it a completely different thing. I got one other artist to help me out making the car that's in that shot, but everything else was just like done very quickly. And that made me realize too, it's like, hey, like you're spending all this time on one individual thing that you're proud of, but it may not, you know, is it going to be the best decision for what's best for the scene, right? And overall, I think that scene plays a lot better than the way it was initially conceived and the way that I was building the environment for, right? And it's like, yeah, it would have been cool to have all this stuff. And I put a lot of time into it, but at the end of the day, it was like, hey, this thing needs to get cut and move, and it's better. The game is better overall for it, right? So making sure that you, again, it kind of goes back to the idea of like understanding where to put the attention to stuff, making sure that you're communicating with the rest of the team on the things that you're working on, so that they can have an understanding of like, hey, maybe you get a hint that this isn't the best spot for the thing that you're trying to make, right? You're like, oh, actually, you know, yeah, I can make this look really cool, but I don't know if it really works with this, right? So just being able to have that communication with the team is also super important. A lot of times I think, especially for students that come out now, you know, you're building these environments on your own, right? Like we talked about this a little while ago about how do you find how someone works on a team? And it's like, a lot of times it's like, oh, we're actually kind of alone on our own and just making our own thing, right? So that's not really emphasized in a lot of schools and a lot of practices of like, hey, you have to work with other people. Hey, your art is not going to be the focus of the game. The experience, the design of it is usually going to be the focus. You know, the artist might be in certain places left alone and just be like, go make this look pretty. Cool, that looks pretty, guys. Thanks. We're going to be over here all discussing these other problems.
It's how you sometimes deal with, and like you said, we are a sensitive bunch, we are. It's how you kind of deal with the, so you might have spent a long time on an environment for a project, and it will change, it could just change overnight. It's how you kind of adapt to that and sort it out, really. And you just don't really get that sometimes with uni, because you know, this is your project, you're going to do it the end. But that's not always, I wish that was the case with video games, like, you know, there's no change whatsoever. But yeah, it's gonna be changed. You're gonna have to rework stuff, and it's just that you don't always know how people are gonna react to that.
I think it's a good way to end this on, or a good note to end this on. Where can people find both of you on the internet?
I think the best one is probably my Twitter. It's Art of L. So yeah, just follow me on there.
And yeah, Twitter, same here, at Brian Reno, which is totally not confusing to most people, but. Yeah,
you can find. I thought it was your Halloween name, and it's like, oh no, it's still there.
yeah, they're like, oh no, wait, is this his actual name, or is this, oh no, I don't know. So, but yeah, but that's my own fault.
And you can follow this podcast on Twitter at ScriptLockCast. Our art was done by Lily Nishida at Lily Nishida on Twitter, and our music was done by Too Mellow at Too Mellow Makes on Twitter. And please leave a review, and that's the show. Thank you, too, for coming on again. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.